Well, hi. This is Bruce McDonald with Academics of PA. And this week with us, we have Norma Ricucci. So, Norma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be part of this.
And kind of getting started, one of the things I find absolutely fascinating about your background is that you have something that nobody else that we've had on the show actually have, and that is a bachelor's degree in public administration.
Yes, I do.
Not that many bachelor's programs in PA.
I'm a rare bird, yes.
Yeah. What I would like to do is kind of start off by asking you, what was it about PA that actually drove you into the field from an earlier stage, whereas kind of most of us found it later on?
Okay. Well, I actually started out in political science. And one of my, this was at FIU, who it was a professor there that suggested I try some of the courses in PA. And of course, I said, what is PA? Didn't know at the time what PA was. I think a lot of people still don't know what it is. But so I went over to the PA department, and they had something called a Bachelor's of Public Administration. And I started taking classes, and I was very drawn to, and have always been drawn to, social equity. And I had some of the readings of the new PA in one of my classes, and George Fredrickson. And I've always been interested in social equity issues from especially a personal standpoint, but also experientially in some work experiences. And so I was really drawn to the field and drawn to the people in the field and what they had to say. But also that I always felt that government had some responsibility for helping to create social equity. And so that really drew me to public administration. And they had a type of program that some would probably say is not a good idea. It was sort of a pre-MPA course. So I had like intro to PA. I had public personnel administration, the courses that you might find in a master's of PA.
Right.
And that's the way it was organized. And I very much liked it. And that's how I earned the BPA. But that helped me, you know, once I got into my MPA program as well. So I had read a lot of the works that people were just beginning to read in MPA programs. So, and I had some really good professors at FIU, people that were alums of the Maxwell School, of USC, and they were really good mentors and encouraged me because I knew I wanted to go on in public administration. And they told me, you need to go on to USC or the Maxwell School for your MPA and then your PhD. So that is how all that happened. So it was really fortuitous that political science professor said, why don't you take a class in public administration?
Are you from Florida originally?
No, I'm from Connecticut, actually.
FIU is just a little bit of a unusual place to have ended up for undergrad if you weren't from Florida.
Well, I actually left where I was living in Connecticut when I was 18. I turned 18. I was of age. I got in my car and took off and ended up in Miami and actually started out working first. So when I left Connecticut, I wasn't planning to go to Florida. I just happened to be driving down the East Coast, and I ended up in Florida, and I very much liked it because it was winter, and it was nice and warm in Florida. And so that's how I ended up in Florida and stayed in Florida and then started school there.
I'm from Tallahassee, so I always have to ask if someone else is a Floridian at heart.
Yes. No, I mean, I ended up there quite accidentally, but again, it turned out to be a very good accident because it paved the way to my academic career, if you will. Just starting at FIU, it was, like I said, very fortuitous.
You had mentioned that one of the things that kind of appealed to you early on in the BPA program was the social equity aspect.
Yes.
Where does that kind of appeal come from, or what initially kind of drove you to that area of interest?
Well, I've always been interested in issues of inequality, and always been interested in how the marginalized and disadvantaged are treated in this country. And so some of the early work experiences I had, I actually saw some of that and understood that these things were unjust. And so some of it, again, was through just lived experiences. And also being a woman and being treated a certain way, and knowing the differential, seeing the differential treatment of myself as a woman compared to some of my male colleagues. So that was something, again, that piqued my interest in issues of social equity, and I've maintained that throughout my entire career. So, you know, I always go back to it. It's always the area that I'm most passionate about.
If I can I ask, you said some of your early work experiences, can I ask kind of what some of those might have been, or?
Yes. One was seeing people of color being fired from their jobs, older people being fired from their jobs for no reason. And for myself, I was doing the work of a supervisor, but they continue to hire men to come in to be supervisors, and I would be training them. And I would have to say, well, why can't I be a supervisor? I'm doing all the work, I'm training them. And it was clear to me why I would never be promoted to a supervisor. And I saw a gender bias there. So again, that coupled with how I saw how older workers were being treated and Black and Latinx were being treated, really, really was, again, that was something that was very personal, obviously. And so what I did was I was able to take that and parlay that into my professional career. And that, again, started early on, you know, by reading the works of the new public administrationists, Marini, and especially George Frederickson, who really referred to social equity as the third pillar in the field. So when you have somebody like that pointing to the importance of social equity, it means a lot.
Right. Interesting kind of to hear your experience of, you know, seeing what's going on in the field in terms of how people are being treated that drives or that initially drove that interest into PA. I'm kind of comparing it to in my head a little bit to when we talked to Camilla Stivers, because she had a fairly similar experience, but her experience came a little bit later in her career, where she was, you know, out in practice, kind of saw how people were being treated and had issues with that, and then used that issue that she was experiencing to kind of be the impetus of going back to grad school. So
yeah,
it's kind of neat to see the two different sides of how people end up doing what they do.
Right. Well, it's interesting, Bruce, because when I go around and give talks based on my research, and if it's gender related, and I make statements, for example, in those presentations, you know, women sometimes afterwards come up to me and say, "I'm so glad you made that statement." And what one of the statements was recent, actually. I was giving a talk at the Paul O'Neill School, SPIA, which we refer to still, but it's the Paul O'Neill School now. And it was a talk on pay equity. And we were talking about pay equity in academia, and in particular in our field. And we were talking about the fact that if people want to get an increase in their pay, they need to go to talk to a dean. And a dean says, go out on the market and get a job offer. And that's basically how you get a pay raise. And I basically raised the issue and the fact, because I think this is empirical, that women don't tend to engage in that behavior. They don't tend to go out on interviews looking for a pay increase. It's not something that maybe we've been trained to do, socialized to do. And many of us look at it in terms of ethics and morality, that you're going out, you're basically costing another institution a lot of money to bring you out for an interview, travel, and so on and so forth. And you have no intention of ever going there. You're only using it to go back to your employer to get a pay increase. Now, of course, sometimes that backfires too, where people do that and your home employer says, well, good luck, you know, go ahead and take it. So sometimes it doesn't always work out for people. But again, the point was that I said, you know, women don't tend to do that. And afterwards, a woman said to me, I'm so glad you said that. So, you know, just going out and sharing my research, I hear people coming up to me. If I'm talking about race issues, gender, ethnicity, people coming up to me, academics, colleagues, assistant professors, associate professors, full professors coming up to me and saying, you know, I'm so glad you're doing research in this area. And it parallels some of my experiences in the field. So that I find both on the one hand rewarding, but also a little disconcerting. But, you know, again, it has relevance.
Given kind of the extent of your career since you graduated in the earlier 80s till now, have you seen there kind of be a lot of a change or any kind of movement in terms of academia doing better about the pay inequities?
I think it's still a pervasive issue. The one thing I've seen as where we've gotten better is that when I came out, there were very few women in public administration, in academia, in the U.S. at least. I can't say this globally. But we have made progress, and that we're seeing more women in the field of public administration. But I think we have not seen enough progress in terms of people of color, African-American faculty, Latinx faculty in our field. I think we have a ways to go here, but certainly since I came out, we're seeing many more women entering the field and entering academia and moving up the hierarchy. I think another area where we still have not seen a lot of progress is women in the role of dean of our schools. And, you know, some of that may be personal choice. Some of it may be as a result of socialization, which, you know, does underlie labor market behaviors of women in every area. So I think we have made some progress, but we've got a ways to go in these other areas.
Trying to think of a nice, good way of putting this. As a white male in academia, it feels like a lot of what I could see myself doing to try and help on the issues might kind of come off a little bit is disingenuous. Thinking about, you know, the inequities within the academy and within PA, what do you think that the people who are kind of along the lines of me, what can we do to help with the issues or raise awareness to the issues or bring fairness to those issues?
Well, I think by virtue of even asking the question, that gets at it right there, that, you know, it is that awareness and, you know, acknowledging, one, that the problem does exist. And it's, you know, some of this has to be done organically. Some of it has to be done institutionally. And so, you know, if you're ever in a position of power, that then you can think of ways to ensure that you're creating a culture where everybody is seen as equal. Everybody has something to offer, that there are no favorites, and one person's not better than the other, that people are judged and evaluated in the same way. And so, like I said, some of it is institutional, positional power, but just the awareness. And I think, you know, by talking about it and by virtue of the fact that you asked the question, and that's, you know, again, is that's important, you know, that people are open to these discussions. I mean, look at the Me Too movement. I mean, I thought that was going to blow up right after Anita Hill gave her testimony when Thomas was up for nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. It took a long time, but it finally did come about. And we're actually seeing strong institutional responses to this problem. And so, you know, things eventually get done. Maybe it takes time, but and people become aware of what's going on, and that might affect their behaviors, which is, you know, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a believer in time, but I wish we could make progress a little bit faster, speed it up a little bit.
I think the inevitable of the academy and the inevitable of government both are relatively slow to change. I think you add kind of the combination of them, and we have to be really, really slow to change.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, as people become more aware of these things, I mean, some people might say, ugh, enough with this Me Too, but it's still happening. And, you know, I was just reading in the paper this morning, the New York Times, that it's still happening. And so, you know, so to the extent that, again, people are realizing the extent of this problem, then we begin to see change. And so awareness is very, very important, as you said yourself.
Kind of making a little bit of a divergence, but still kind of in the same area.
Okay.
Since you do the vast majority of your research on, you know, issues of social equity and the issue of employment, it's a fairly large issue with a lot that's going on and a lot that needs extra work or extra research on.
Yeah.
How do you, as a researcher, parse down the different aspects of here's what you're going to focus on this paper, here's what comes in the paper that, you know, follows, given that there is just so much to be done?
Yes.
I know that's a heavy, large question. But.
No, it's actually a perfect question, because I have so many ideas of so many things I would like to do, but know that, one, time constraints, cost constraints, you know, because we're in a field that we don't really benefit from funding opportunities. And so, that's certainly a hindrance. But I have a lot of ideas and a lot of just always some plans to do various research projects. And I know I'll never get to all of them, but I do try to pass them on to doctoral students, and hopefully they'll pick up some of them. But and they eventually. You know, things that I've thought about come back to me. In fact, there's a project right now that I'm starting to work on. I looking back at what demographers had to say about the demographic changes. They talked about this in the 80s, and that we would see demographic shifts, and which would ultimately lead to more women and people of color in the workplace, and more opportunities, and so on and so forth. And I decided I wanted to look back on that and see what exactly has happened. And there really hasn't been a lot of work looking at this. And slowly, as I'm looking at the picture, I'm looking at, well, we haven't invested in opportunities for women and people of color. And so they're still lagging in terms of making it up to higher level positions. But the one group that has lagged behind more than others has been Black men in terms of gaining entrance into the workforce and gaining progress, moving up through the ranks. There was supposed to be a lot of opportunities in IT for women and people of color, and some of that has just not materialized. And again, the group that seems to be worse off through all this is Black men. And so you know, it took some time to get back to this project, but I had a little bit of time, and I said, let me just start looking at the numbers. And so I'm working on that piece right now. I had planned to work on that like 5 years ago, but now I've just got the time to do it. I do get, you know, I get a lot of requests to do book chapters and participate in symposia, and I do that, and it's time consuming, but it is a service to our community, to our research community, practitioner community. And so as I do those things, I sometimes am unable to pick up on the research agenda that I have laid out for myself. But it's all good. You know, I'm happy with the work that I'm doing, that I've done, and know that I'll get to some of this. And if I don't, like I said, I pass it on to a PhD student. And again, when I go out to speak on my research, I continually point to, well, here are some openings. These are some things that have to be done. And hopefully people are picking up on those threads.
I have two questions kind of stewing in my head.
Okay.
The first is thinking about, that there are these different threads and the different research opportunities that you kind of let people know about, I think is interesting, but I also think it's a little bit different. You know, as academics, we tend to be a little bit more centered around my own research rather than the broader agenda of the issue.
Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, when I was with the Journal of Public and Nonprofit Affairs, we started a section on survey articles that were kind of the, here's the issue, everything you need to know about it, and then lay out an agenda for additional research on the issue. And we actually had a fairly hard time getting people being willing to write articles for it. In part, I think, because people didn't want to say, here's what needs to be done, because they wanted to be the ones to always do it.
Right.
I don't know a good way of kind of overcoming that, but I like the fact that you're saying, here are these topics that you're interested in, but admitting that you have that time limitation,
right,
handing them off to somebody who might be kind of trying to get started, but they don't necessarily know where to go yet.
Right. Well, that is just sort of paying it forward, if you will, but I know that the people that are coming to hear my talks, when I'm invited, for example, to give a talk, that the people that are showing up are the people that are interested in the topic. And so there are always a lot of PhD students that come to these, of course. And so, it's not dogmatism. It's more, look, here are some opportunities. These are things that need to be done. It's a way of trying to advance scholarship on race and gender and ethnicity issues. And, keeping that door open for people that are interested in those areas. I certainly wouldn't, be proselytizing anybody who was not interested in those issues. It's more, these are some areas of opportunities, and you might want to seize them. If you're not sure what you're going to do with your dissertation, talk to your main mentor and go from there. So, again, it's not dogmatism. It's more, giving people some ideas, providing opportunities for areas that need to be further researched, hopefully seeing people carry that forward.
I think it's a good practice. I mean, I have a list of all the different projects that I would like to accomplish.
Yep.
And it's several pages long, and it's
yes,
maybe one sentence per project.
Yep, exactly. And you'll get to some of them, but you won't to others. And, acknowledging that you're not going to get to all of them is, that's realistic. It's not like I get bummed out or anything, but, that's realistic. You just don't have the time to do it all, but you just pinpoint these areas that could really use additional research. So
how do you pick which ones are the areas to pinpoint?
Well, I try to look at the areas that haven't really been researched enough. So it's, trying to move the literature forward. Where do I see the gaps? And trying to move it forward in that direction. For example, some of my recent work on representative bureaucracy was in the area of symbolic representation, and there wasn't a lot of work there, or hasn't been. And so, I was looking for ways to advance that scholarship. So it's always looking at, where are the gaps? What can I do? And it's just the questions that interest me. And that's important. And I always say that when I talk to especially doctoral students, put the research question first before the methods. And how are you going to do it? What are you doing? What's the question? Then figure out how you're going to do it. But it's those research questions that I formulate, and I'm very motivated to research and study.
I think it's interesting you put the research question first. Mm-hmm. So I'll admit I teach the research design course for PhD students here, and we use your book.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
Which, it's a great book. And one of the things that I always kind of come back to with the students is focusing on the front half before you ever touch or think about the methods.
Right.
Because you don't necessarily know what's going to be most appropriate. You don't necessarily know what the method should look like, given, you know, you don't know what the literature says yet.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's hard for them to overcome that because everybody wants to play with data.
Right. I think it may be that everybody wants to play with data because it's expedient. I mean, people may want to be doing qualitative research, but it's very difficult and time consuming. Mm-hmm. You know, especially for, you know, in our field, you know, junior faculty members are looking to get tenure. They can't spend 5 years working on a qualitative project, which, you know, will give you great context for what you're studying, but you have to produce. And so I think there's pressure, academics who even might want to do good qualitative research, that find that it's not a fruitful way to think about getting tenure. So, and I talk about these things to my students, because a lot of them are interested in qualitative work, because you do get a lot more context when you're doing qualitative work, but it takes longer. And so the outcome, the end product, is, you know, a ways away from the actual research. So I think that's, so even philosophically speaking, you know, I mean, I think the field in general does tend to favor quantitative empirical research. But I think just pragmatically, it's what people need to pursue in order to get tenure. And that is a goal. You know, that's job security. So,
right.
But, you know, good qualitative research is really, I think, hard to find in our field. We do see it. And then, you know, the really good theory pieces, like, you know, Cam Stivers that you talked about has done some amazing work on women in public administration. And, you know, and she doesn't have to crunch numbers to do it. So you know, there are trade-offs, but I think there's room for both. And I, you know, I think the field recognizes that, but you just have to know where to send your material. You send your manuscripts, because, you know, some journals won't take anything that's not quantitative, and other journals will.
Thinking about when you are kind of advising a PhD student or kind of giving feedback or recommendations to someone who might be early in their career, if they're kind of struggling with this idea of they want to do qualitative, but given the concerns about the timeline to publication and everything else, what would you really tell them to kind of do, or how would you approach giving them advice?
Well, I tell them to do the qualitative work, but be vigilant of trying to get some things published along the way, either from that particular project or from other projects, you know, because you have to, in our profession, just juggle a number of things. And so that's what I tell them. Really, you know, pursue the qualitative, but try to publish other things along the way, maybe from your interviews, or, you know, whatever you're working, whatever method you're using. But, you know, don't shy away from that if that's what your real interest is. Because, you know, once you're tenured and you feel like you have a little bit more time, you might be willing to engage in more qualitative research. I mean, that's what I hear from a lot of people. I wish I could, or I wish I had the time to do right. Good qualitative research. You know, we're not like history where you can publish one book and then get tenure. That those aren't the norms of our field. So, you know, but you could do that book after you're tenured. And, you know, again, it's about juggling different projects. You're working on that, but there's always other things you're going to be working at simultaneously. And you get those published. So that's That's what I say to students who say to me, I wish I had time to do qualitative work. You know, when I was not yet tenured, I knew that, again, this was something I wanted to do at some point in my career. And when my first sabbatical came up, I decided I was going to do it. And that was this Unsung Heroes, Execucrats Making a Difference. And it was almost a way to protect the field and to basically, it was an anti-bureaucrat bashing book. You know, it's like, look at all these really solid career officials, sort of what we're seeing now in the newspaper around the impeachment, all these career officials and career diplomats that are getting fired from their jobs for political reasons. But, you know, here are all these career people that do really important stuff and really make a difference in our lives. And so I took a year off and I spent most of it in Washington, D.C. and interviewed all these people and wrote this book. Now, you know, some people might say, oh, this is just case studies, it's best practices, but I feel there's a room for that. I feel that it's important to students. I feel it's important to practitioners. After all, we are an applied field. And I think it's important for even our colleagues to see, you know, what people in the field are doing and the challenges they face. And so, you know, I made a conscious effort to work on that. And it really was a labor of love. I so much enjoyed myself. I so much enjoyed talking to people, you know, getting into the context of what they do and how they do it. And, you know, that was the first book I did with Georgetown University Press, which was a really good project and a good experience. So it's possible. It's just, you know, what you want to do with your time and how you want to parcel out your time. And so it's, you know, what your goals are, really.
How has your research agenda changed pre-tenure and post-tenure? You know, given that you have the freedom post-tenure to kind of do the studies that are more interesting or more important to you.
Well, I don't think it's changed. That's why I said this, you know, this one study going down to Washington, that, you know, that was really pre-tenure. And you know, so things that I wanted to do pre-tenure are some of the things I do now. So, you know, that I may be an anomaly, but I decided, you know, there's certain things I want to do. And when I wasn't tenured, I said, well, this is what I want to do. I'm publishing. If it's not appreciated where I am and not recognized and respected and I don't get tenure, well, then I'll go someplace else. So I really did what I wanted to do and studied the things I wanted to do and study them how I wanted to study them. And I like to feel that it did serve me well. At least I benefited from them professionally and even personally. I mean, you know, talking to people and what they do and how they do it, how they manage the challenges they face, you know, as high-level bureaucrats. You know, if somebody would go in and do a study now on this, the Ukrainian ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, mm-hmm. I mean, that I'm so compelled by her testimony before Congress. I mean, her story, it's just riveting. And this is a career bureaucrat, a career diplomat who devoted her entire life to the service, foreign service, basically. And now she's being treated in a way it's so humiliating. Her, you know, her work is being demeaned. I think people would want to hear her story. I mean, I learned that she's already got a post at Georgetown. And I'm thinking, good, somebody sees the value here. You know, these are the experiences that I think are heartening for you know, not just our students. I mean, we're training people for government service, but also people who are already in government. And then even for scholars, you know. So I, you know, I'm very heartened by her and her story. I'm very sorry for what she's going through right now. But she's been picked up by Georgetown, so people recognize that she's, you know, value added, if you will.
One of the things I think that's interesting about the Unsung Heroes book is that it does kind of have those stories. And even though it's not a traditional long academic book of, you know, theory building or anything else, I think there's a lot of times people in PA, we go into the field because we're interested in it, but we don't necessarily have the practice experience within the realm of government or working for nonprofits.
Right.
And so we know what it's like from kind of our context, which might be fairly small.
Yep.
But actually having something that says, you know, here's how people actually in the field are doing things and doing them well.
Right.
I think that's important.
I do think it's important too. And I think it actually helps to build theory on, you know, the theory on leadership and, you know, especially in government. And again, serves as an important model for people going into public service. So for students, for practitioners, and like I said, even for academics, because sometimes we just sit in our little, you know, our little cubicles and we do our work and, you know, we stop to think about really what public service is all about and what public servants are doing and the challenges they face. And it's particularly critical now during this administration that really has no value for public servants. I don't want to turn this into a political stage, but you know, here is an administration that's been wanting to drain the swamp in Washington and has absolutely no conception of how important they are to the American people, or even beyond. You know, it gives a little glimpse of what public servants do to not just students, but to our colleagues as well.
Not necessarily even the political side of it. If we think about MPA programs, even before Trump, were having a harder time getting people into going or being interested in government service and interested in going into the federal government service.
Yeah.
Which is becoming a much larger problem as we have large numbers of government employees starting to get to the retirement age, and we don't necessarily have people there who are prepared to take over in those positions.
Right. Yes. Yeah. This is a problem for academia overall, because, I mean, as academia, as programs in every field become more tuition driven, you're going to see smaller departments or schools. You're probably going to see more NTTs, non-tenure track faculty members hired, where tenure track faculty members had heretofore been hired. So I think it's in general this problem with, you know, attracting students to programs. It's not just PA. It goes beyond our field, but I think it's really going to bring monumental change to academia in general.
Yeah, I have faith, but I'm also not exactly sure how it's going to look at the end of the day. But I have faith that at some point we'll kind of make a little bit of a turn.
Well, I think what some institutions are doing, and I see it in public administration or public affairs programs across the country, is they're starting to add undergraduate education, where prior to these times, you know, you had an MPA and you had a PhD or an MPP, but no undergraduate programs. And I think you're going to see many more institutions starting undergraduate programs. And a big part of that is for tuition. And that, I mean, unfortunately, we're seeing, you know, money driving pedagogy, but that's, I think, probably one of the first things we're beginning to see. I think the second, like I said, is more non-tenure track faculty members. So they're not adjunct, you're bringing them on for, you know, 3 years, 5 years, whatever the contract might be, and they have PhDs, and they're doing most of the teaching, but they also don't get paid as much. In some places, they don't get the benefits, especially if they're not unionized. And so there's inequity. There's a good instance of where you're going to see some inequities. But yeah, I think we're going to see more of that as we move forward.
Out of curiosity, since you did your undergraduate NPA and then went to the MPA and PhD, thinking about those undergraduate programs, is having an undergraduate program in PA helpful? Or would you kind of think back and say it might have been nice to have majored in something else to give kind of a little bit broader of a educational experience prior to going to grad school?
Well, I think you get that in any undergraduate program because you have, you know, part of the liberal arts there. I benefited from it because I really became very devoted to public administration as a field. And I think if I didn't have the undergraduate training, I wouldn't have had that, I wouldn't say level of commitment, but devotion and protective. I mean, that's why I say I'm very protective of public administration. And if anybody says anything derogatory about it, I'm, you know, quick to fight back, if you will.
I like it.
So I think having the undergraduate degree, but I don't think undergraduate degrees in general are similar to what I had. I think most of them are more sort of, public service oriented. So you're not going to get that pre-MPA. You're not going to get an intro to public administration. You're not going to get a budgeting class. They are conceived of in different ways, and they're more general, if you will. So you maybe more public affairs than public administration. So I see the importance of that. But I feel I personally benefited from having the undergraduate degree the way it was shaped. But, you know, again, I don't know how. I think most of the people, well, I can say really the people I went to school with back then were not going on for a PhD. So did it probably help them too in an MPA program.
Yeah.
So, and let's face it, I think people that are going on for, you know, master's degrees now, it's really being driven by money, by finance, you know. So if you can go into a program that picks up from what you did in your undergraduate, it's going to help you greatly. And helps you get through the program faster. So to be blunt, I think those people that went on for MPAs were probably happy to have it delivered in that fashion. But I think it was an anomaly. Like I said, I don't think most undergraduate programs are, you know, like you said, a BPA. I don't know anybody else with a Bachelor's of Public Administration. I don't know if FIU still offers it in that fashion. And, you know, I've never really looked back to see what they do with their undergraduate degree. It may be totally different now.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm tempted to go back and look at it now, so see what they do.
So I went to FSU for my PhD, and I know at one point FSU had an undergraduate degree in public administration, but they got rid of it, I think, in the mid-80s.
To focus
on the graduate side.
Ah, okay.
And I know there were a number of other programs that kind of did similar choices, or at least I've heard that there are other programs.
That's interesting. And you know, maybe they're bringing back those programs now, like I said, for financial reasons. But, you know, you're right. I don't even know if they have an undergraduate program there anymore. They may have totally gotten rid of it. So now I'm inspired to go back and look, though. So I'm going to do that.
One thing I did want to ask before we ran out of time,
sure.
The book on traditions of inquiry and philosophies of knowledge, it's a great book, but it is fairly different than everything else you've really done.
Right.
And it's fairly different than most other books within PA. We see a lot of these kind of books within, you know, the philosophy of science, like those kind of books, but there's not really anything else that I've really seen that's PA oriented. So I'm kind of curious what drove the motivation to do it, and what were you kind of hoping to have the field gain from this publication?
Well, it's something that I was interested in doing for a long time, probably when I first went out on my job interviews after I earned my PhD. And I think one of the things was, I remember it quite well, going into you know, you have a faculty interview and you go into a group setting where you've got a group of faculty members and they're going to interview you. Well, walking into that setting, and before I was even introduced or got to introduce myself, somebody, you know, went up, shook my hand and said, "So what were the methods of your dissertation?" And that really disturbed me. Now, I didn't want to fly off the handle and say anything. Like, why would, you know, would you like me to introduce myself first? Or, you know, I wasn't in a position to say anything because I was on a job interview and I obviously wanted the job, which I did get, but that really, really annoyed me. And I felt, you know, is that what I'm reduced to as a person, as an academic, what my methods are? And then, you know, as I was, you know, going through as an assistant professor, and I saw some of these arguments about, you know, what counts in the field? Does it have to count to count? And so I've always had this in the back of my mind that the field needed to be, you know, a field that's built on normative foundation has to have an appreciation for all kinds of methods. It has to be a range of methods. And we need methodological pluralism in the field. And that's what really prompted me to write this. So it was something that I thought about for a long time. And is, you know, again, something that I knew I wanted to write on. And that's what prompted it. And I still believe the field gains from methodological pluralism. We can't have, you know, be unidimensional. There's a lot to be gained from research in a number of different areas. You know, and even if you don't, you know, even if you think that the field is better by having just quantitative empiricism, at least you have to be open to the fact that that is not the only way.
Right.
You know, we have learned in our field there is no one best way. Take that to its limit and its meaning. There is no one best way. And so that's what prompted that. And, you know, some probably responded to it negatively. One didn't like, I heard through the grapevine, didn't like being called the logical positivist. But, in the spirit of keeping a dialogue going in the field, that's what I wanted to do. I've heard from so many PhD students that said, at least you helped to clarify some of the things in the field that are so cryptic and Byzantine. And I did that purposefully. I didn't write that for my colleagues. I wrote it for PhD students. So it was written, you know, in a way that could be comprehended by students, and not some, like I said, you know, huge cryptic Byzantine book that would, you know, that would help scholars in the field. They were already there. They already knew what they were going to do. They went through the system. So it wasn't written for them. And I know some have knocked it as being, you know, it wasn't rigorous enough. But, you know, again, it was written at a student level. It wasn't written for academics. But I think, I have to say, I've heard from colleagues too, that it, you know, obviously it's gotten some good reviews, that, you know, it's about time somebody wrote something like that. I have never regretted anything I've ever done, maybe personally, but not professionally. I mean, anything I've worked on or written, I can say I don't regret anything I've done, and I feel like it's made a contribution. So, but you're absolutely on target. It was different from most of the things that I wrote. But what makes it similar is that the issue of equity. Everything should be, you know, on equal grounds, qualitative versus quantitative, and postmodern versus interpretist, and ethnographic versus, and so on and so forth. You know, don't don't belittle the work because it doesn't count.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of kind of couching that into the broader agenda of the research.
Right, exactly. Well, thank you. Actually, I'd never thought about it until you you encouraged me to think about it. So thank you for stimulating that that point of discussion.
Well, one of the things I like about it, and one of the reasons why I use it, I can get up there and talk about, Popper, Kuhn, Lakatos, Pugliani, everybody else. I can talk about the difference between quantitative and qualitative by pulling in King, Cohen, and Verba's book or the Creswell and Creswell book. Mm-hmm. But they're all coming from different fields. And so there's nothing really out there within PA that says, here's all these different ideas of what it actually means and how it's actually applied back to the kind of things that you do. And so I kind of use the book as, here's everything else. Here's the translation or interpretation of it back to you.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate when somebody actually recognizes what I tried to do with it and that it does absolutely go beyond public administration. And that was my intention. And so thank you for acknowledging that. It's appreciated.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah. Well, I've kept you for a nice bit of time. I certainly don't want to take up all of your afternoon, but I want to thank you for coming on and joining me today.
Thank you, Bruce. This was really very delightful to speak with you. You asked some really good probing questions. I have to say I had to step back a minute and think about how I wanted to respond to some of them earlier, the early on questions. but you're a great interviewer. Let's put it that way.
Well, thank you.